Good evening. Welcome behind the news for November 21, 2002. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. So we've got three segments up for tonight. First, we'll speak with Alexandra Robbins, who is the author of a new book called Secrets of the Tomb, a history and investigation into Skull and Bones, the Yale Secret Society, and what it's all about, and why anyone should care who's not immediately associated with it. Then around the bottom of the hour, we'll listen to an interview recorded yesterday with Linda Gruen, who is a Walmart worker who has turned union organizer in honor of today's union-organized day of action against Walmart to events around the country about their efforts to unionize the very low-paid and extremely exploited, mostly female labor force of the world's largest corporation. And then finally, we'll hear from Amy Kayatza, who is a researcher with the Institute for Women's Policy Research, who is the editor of a volume they just published, The Status of the Women in the States, The Status of Women in the States, Politics, Economics, Health, Rights, and Demographics, which is available on the Institute for Women's Policy Research website. And they'll give you further information about that when we get to that interview. So we've got a full plate, so let's get started and welcome Alexandra Robbins, who is an author of, and journalist, a fairly recent graduate of Yale, but a rather long set of publishing credits. Welcome to WBAI, Alexandra Robbins.
Thank you.
So, Skull and Bones. I imagine a lot of listeners know what that is, but could you just give us the three-sentence description of what this entity is and why anyone should care about it?
Sure. Skull and Bones is probably the most infamous secret society in the world. It's rumored to be a wealthy landowner that guaranteed its members power and financial security for life. And it's a society that, a tiny society, that includes among its membership presidents of the United States, such as George W. Bush and his father, congressmen, senators, such as Senator John Kerry, which will make the presidential election of 2004 particularly interesting if it's the first Bones versus Bones ballot, and then Supreme Court Chief Justices, cabinet members, business tycoons, CIA directors. The list of alumni of this tiny organization is just staggering.
When was it founded?
Skull and Bones was founded in 1832 by a guy named William Russell, who later became a general in the Civil War and a member of the Connecticut State Legislature. Apparently, William Russell studied abroad at the end of his junior year. He was in Germany. While in Germany, he came across some German secret society, and when he came back to Yale, Phi Beta Kappa, of which he had been a member, which had been a secret society up until that time, was suddenly stripped of its secrecy in the midst of the anti-Masonic fever. William Russell was incensed that he no longer had a secret society, so he decided to begin one, originally calling it the Eulogian Club, and then a year later changing the name to Skull and Bones, as the American chapter of the German secret society he found when he was abroad.
Now, the name Skull and Bones, and many of the things you write about in the book, suggest a rather rapt fascination with death. What is it about Skull and Bones and death?
Yes, Skull and Bones does have a very strong death motif. If you look inside their tomb, which is what they call the sort of crypt-like three-story building that they use at headquarters in the middle of the Yale campus in New Haven, you'll find dozens of skeletons, skulls, a mummy. They stole the gravestone of Elihu Yale, supposedly, from a churchyard in Wrexham. They have art that glorifies death and celebrates war. And the point of all that, as one bonesman told me, is to remind the members of Skull and Bones that life is short, essentially, and that they only have a short period of time during which they have the means to succeed and to bring back the honor onto Skull and Bones that, as members, they are expected to do.
Now, when I was at Yale in the early 70s, this was a time when no one really, Skull and Bones was a bit of a joke. I mean, we were all kind of fascinated by these windowless crypts scattered around the campus, but you know, people kind of laughed at it. A couple of my friends were inducted, but none of my regular circle were actually considered candidates. What's the reputation of Skull and Bones like these days?
It's actually making a huge comeback, both because of the Bush political dynasty. There have been nine Bushes in Skull and Bones. There, I'm sure, will be 10 in April when George W.'s daughter Barbara is eligible for membership. And also because of the media. We have movies like The Skulls, and they actually came out with a sequel that I believe went straight to video, that sort of fictionalizes Skull and Bones. It was a movie based on this society. And you have things like a lot of conspiracy theorists use the Internet as a medium through which to propagate these kinds of rumors and mythologies about the society, which really only increases the power of a place like Skull and Bones, which thrives on the way that it's viewed in the public eye.
And speaking of the Internet, I actually retrieved what purports to be a membership list of the Internet of Skull and Bones. And there, let's see, Edwards Denmore Robbins and William Wells Robbins of 1874 and 1927. Any relations?
No. My name was actually changed to Robbins sometime in the past 200 years, I think.
Uh-huh.
So that wouldn't have been me. But, yeah, that membership list has some true names. It also has some false names. I know which one you're talking about. But some of the true ones include, say, David McCullough, who is the Pulitzer Prize-winning biography, Henry Luce and Britton Haddon, the founders of Time Magazine, Averill Harriman, who actually Brown Brothers Harriman merged because of Bonesman Partners at Brown Brothers and at W.H. Harriman and W.A. Harriman, and in 1972, more than a third of the partners at Brown Brothers Harriman were members of Skull and Bones. Their roster is just incredible, in my opinion.
Yeah, but actually, there are neighbors, Brown Brothers Harriman, just down the street from where I'm sitting right now. Okay, now, you've touched on something that, of course, is what makes everybody fascinated by this, or ranging from respectable interest to paranoid conspiratorial interest. But in the extreme versions, this is a secret government, a mini ruling class establishment that pulls the strings of governments and financial institutions and basically one of those little groups of folks that run the world. How much truth is there to this caricature?
Well, the caricature in the extreme that somehow men meet in this tomb on the Yale campus and orchestrate a secret world government and plot certain foreign policies and political mandates, that's not true. But if you want to look at it a little more subtly, the point of Skull and Bones is its network. It has an amazing network, and the purpose, the agenda of Skull and Bones is to propel its members to positions of power and then to encourage those members to hire other Bonesmen. We do see that happening. One of the first appointments that George W. Bush made was one of his fellow 1968 Skull and Bones classmates to the position of Assistant Attorney General of the largest litigation component in the Justice Department. We also see that Bush's first choice for Secretary of Defense was a guy named Fred Smith. He's the CEO of Federal Express and a Bonesman. He withdrew from consideration because of health reasons. The General Counsel of the Office of Homeland Security, another position appointed by Bush, is a member of Skull and Bones. So we do see that there are strings pulled. We have seen historically there have been strings pulled. You can start with the Harrimans in the 1920s, 1930s. They had some influence at Newsweek, and when Averill Harriman was upset with something that Newsweek wrote, he talked to his brother Roland Harriman, who had something to do with the board, and they talked to some Bonesmen at Newsweek, and they were able to pull strings. You look at World War II, Henry Stimson, Secretary of War under FDR, was in charge of the deployment of the atomic bomb, and when he hired the members of his war cabinet, he felt that members of Skull and Bones were the most qualified men. He generally believed that you were not a man of merit unless you had been through Yale and a member of Skull and Bones. So he hired three members of Skull and Bones in his war department and put them in charge of the committee that oversaw the deployment of the atomic bomb. So we see that happening, and very subtly, Skull and Bones has, in that way, through individuals and through sort of subgroups within the society, has had a great deal of influence on American history.
But of course, this is a group of, 15 of Yalies from picked out of a junior class.
Right.
Just these 15 are the very best. I mean, even, they can't even broaden their old school ties to include the other 1,000 or so people who weren't tapped.
Well, I think you and I both know as Yalies that the 15 men, and now women are included, who are chosen for membership at Skull and Bones each year are not necessarily the most deserving people at Yale.
That's for sure. The guy, one of the people I knew who was a member, couldn't hold a job, but he just kept finding new ones miraculously.
Imagine.
I can't imagine why. I'm speaking with Alexander Robbins, who is the author of Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, The Ivy League, and The Hidden Paths of Power, just published by Little Brown. And you touched on the co-education of Skull and Bones. People refer to Bonesmen, but in 1991, they finally admitted women after, a 20-year controversy. Your story about that meeting in the French restaurant when they were talking about in the early 70s is interesting. What happened when the rebel class proposed bringing in women?
Yeah, the class of 1971, the 15 seniors who graduated in 1971 who are members of Skull and Bones, was and forever will be known as the Bad Club within Skull and Bones because they had it in their heads that they wanted to tap the first women into the society. They had lined up three women whom, in their words, were ready and willing to be what they called the Jackie Robinsons of Skull and Bones. So they planned to tap the women. When the alumni got wind of this, they insisted that class of 1971 come meet them at a restaurant in New York City so they could, quote-unquote, discuss the issue. Well, the class of 1971 piled into sort of a big blue van, and as you said, people were sort of more lax about secret societies during the 70s just because of the aura of the time. So the band pulls up to the fancy New York restaurant. They open the door. Smoke comes billowing out a la Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and this group of basically hippies come out of the van and into the restaurant ready to sit down and state their case. And when they get there, it's a very fancy, formal affair. They find that the alumni, there are hundreds of alumni there who are at tables, and each table has an empty place so that each of the 15 men cannot sit with each other. They have to sit at a table full of alumni. So there they dine, and the members of the class of 71 stand up. One guy who gave a particularly impassioned speech is a guy who's a Hollywood actor now. His name is Chuck Levin, and he supposedly gave just a wonderful speech explaining why it was so important to let women into this club. Well, one by one, some of the more famous alumni, McGeorge Bundy, for example, made cracks about this.
Yeah, his crack is rich. It's Aunt Jemima's coming to dinner.
Right. They basically belittled the men for saying that they wanted to tap women. And at one point, somebody in the class of 1971 said something like, well, women can do everything that we do in Skull and Bones. Jonathan Bush, at this point, this is George W. Bush's uncle, shot up out of his chair and said, then you're not doing it right. And the members of 71 were thinking, gosh, well, what were these guys actually doing in the tomb, these 15 men? Anyway, the meeting ended by the alumni saying, look, you can either sit with us in the restaurant and tap men instead of women, or you can leave. So eight men left, seven men stayed, and Skull and Bones remained a single-sex institution until 1991. In 1991, the seniors who graduated in 91 said they were tapping women. The alumni locked them out of the tomb. The seniors filed a lawsuit. The alumni filed a lawsuit back, led by William F. Buckley. They claimed that letting women into the tomb would lead to, quote, date rape in the medium-term future. It came down to a very close vote, and women were just narrowly let into the society. Senator John Kerry and former Senator David Boren have disclosed that they voted to let women in. The Bushes have never disclosed which way they voted, but we can guess.
Well, you also quote W as saying that Yale went downhill once it started admitting women.
Right, and Jonathan Bush, even in 1991, was continuing to lobby strenuously against letting women in, which is interesting now because if he had had his way, his niece Barbara wouldn't be tapped in April.
You mentioned David Boren, who was, I believe, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee back in the 80s, early 90s. And, of course, there's a lot of bonesmen all over the history of the CIA.
Absolutely.
This is, of course, rich ground for conspiracy theorists. Could you talk a little bit about that Yale-Bone-CIA connection?
Sure. Well, basically, when you have one member of Skull and Bones in any institution, you're pretty much guaranteed to have more. So Skull and Bones started recruiting members in the CIA. There were dozens and dozens and dozens. George Bush was a Skull and Bonesman, and he was the director of the CIA. It came to be that there were so many Yaleys and so many members of Skull and Bones in the CIA that even at remote outposts like Asia and Africa, Sometimes festive gatherings of CIA officials would end with the Whiffenpoof song, which is, of course, a very traditional Yale song. And it was said that the CIA men who were not members of Skull and Bones and not graduates of Yale often felt inferior to what they called the Yalies.
Now, this would all, some of it, some of the rituals you describe and the paraphernalia sound kind of like adolescent boys with their secret handshakes and in their secret clubs. These are guys who have very substantial positions of power and influence in the world. What do you think about an institution that is extremely secretive, that refers jokingly or not to non-members as barbarians? What kind of mindset emerges from Skull and Bones? Is this the kind of thing we want running the world?
To answer that short term, the mindset is bizarre. Is it the kind of thing we want? No, absolutely not. I mean, this is a group that... it's historically misogynistic. They have traces of racism and anti-Semitism in their past. They adhere to a death motif. They follow this mythology that, I'll tell you the folklore very quickly. In 322 BC, the Greek orator Demosthenes died. When he died, Eulogia, who was the goddess of eloquence, according to Skull and Bones legend, arose to the heavens and didn't come back down again until 1832, when she happened to take up residence in Skull and Bones. Everything in Skull and Bones is done, as they say it, in deference to the goddess. They sing their sacred anthems, which they call them. One of them is actually the tune of the German national anthem. They sing them about the goddess. They have a shrine to the goddess that they open up before each meeting. They call themselves the Knights of Eulogia, and they are encouraged to... go out and steal things of value in the world and bring them back to the tomb. They call them gifts to the goddess, and that's how Geronimo's skull most likely came to be within the tomb. That's how Elihu Yale's gravestone, and supposedly there's an item in the tomb, I don't know what it is yet, that is accompanied by a plaque that says that the plaque was stolen by, that says that the item was stolen by George H.W. Bush, class of 48. This is a group that is involved in some bizarre rituals, but most of all, it's a secret society, and I don't think people in this country want people in a secret society running the government and having so much influence, because this is not a group that represents the rest of American life.
They also seem to think they're above the law. I mean, you mentioned these episodes of thievery that they think they can get away with. There's one episode of their having stolen a $20,000 painting.
Right. And they tried to get away with it by saying, oh, well, we had to do it for Skull and Bones. It was part of the scheduled activity. These are also men who feel like they can bully other people into getting their way. After I wrote an article for the Atlantic Monthly about Skull and Bones and George W. Bush, that was sort of the beginnings of Secrets of the Tomb, this was a couple years ago, I got a call at my office at the New Yorker from a fellow journalist whom I knew to be a member of Skull and Bones, and at first he was very nice, and he said, your article was more accurate than anything else on Skull and Bones we've seen, congratulations, went on, and then he said, we would just like to know the name of the bonesman to whom you spoke. And of course, I'm not going to tell him that, even though he said, we just want to talk to them. You know, right. So I told him I wouldn't reveal my sources, and then he got very angry. He berated me for about 10 to 15 minutes, yelling at me about it, what a dishonorable job I did, how what I did was not ethical journalism. And then at the end he says to me, and at this point I was 23, an aspiring investigative journalist, not really sure where my career would or could possibly go, he said to me, you know, there are a number of us at newspapers and magazines and political institutions across the country. Good luck with your career. And he slammed down the phone. And that is the kind of mindset we do see, not among all bonesmen, certainly. There are groups of bonesmen who just did it to make 14 new friends and have sort of a sweet nostalgia about their time in the tomb. But some bonesmen are very serious about this and believe they have this sort of invisible sort of power that enables them to be above the rest of us and to act superior and to put the rest of us down.
Speaking with Alexandra Robbins, who is the author of Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, the Ivy League, and the Hidden Paths of Power, just published by Little Brown. Now, there are a lot of myths or reports, we don't know whether they're mythical or not, that circulate about Skull and Bones. One, of course, is the initiation ritual in which the initiate lies in a coffin and recites his sexual history. Is there any truth to this?
Yeah, well, you forgot the most interesting part, which is that he's supposed to be masturbating while he does this, according to the rumor. And it's kind of funny. That rumor is so prevalent that foreign reporters have seen it and have wondered seriously in print with some consternation whether this is something that our President Bush engaged in. That is not true. At least it's not true now, and it hasn't been true in recent years. Although, if you go back to the 1800s and you have this building, this windowless building where you have 15 guys in there doing God knows what for 7 hours, who knows what they actually did. However, I found, and I was surprised to find, that many of these rumors are based on some kernel of truth. In this case, the kernel of truth is the sexual history. When you are initiated into Skull and Bones as a junior in April, you have about, I think, a couple weeks, and then they take you to their private island, Deer Island, which they own, for sort of a bonding experience, and then you scatter for the summer. When you come back in September, your very first activity is the sexual history. And during this activity, which Skull and Bones calls connubial bliss, an evening is devoted to each of the 15 members, or they're called knights. Each knight spends an evening standing in front of a painting of a woman in a cozy, dimly lit room, and there that knight must recount to the other 14 members his or her entire sexual history, starting with the first masturbatory experience and on through present day. And this is an activity that's supposed to take up to 3 hours. And, I mean, from my Yale experience, I think that, I mean, from the people I knew, I don't see how that discussion could take 3 hours. So it probably depends on how much how much energy they feel like putting into embellishing that evening. But that is a regularly scheduled and crucial part of the Skull and Bones experience. It's something that George W. would have done. It's something that his father would have done. It's something that Senator Kerry would have done. And I think the reasoning behind it is because the year in Skull and Bones is intended to make these 15 new members as loyal to each other as possible. So after they graduate, they're less likely to betray the society, because to betray the society would mean to betray their new friends. And how better to sort of feel a bond of intimacy between strangers if suddenly you've shared your most intimate confidences?
Oh, now, what has the admission of women done to this ritual? Any ideas?
I would guess nothing. It might have even made the sexual histories even more graphic than they used to be. You know, women are pretty strong-minded.
This sounds like one of these rituals. The old days, it sounds like the rituals of what theorists called homosocial bonding, where it's all this very sexualized, but covertly so, relation,
right,
among men. Again, you know, what does this kind of thing say about the consciousness of people who enter and emerge from this institution?
This is an institution that is a throwback. This is an institution that hasn't changed its ways, except for the inclusion of women, since 1832. Same rituals, same buildings, same agendas. So I think it's pretty scary that we have an institution that is from 1832 that still has so much influence today.
You also, this is organized as a charitable trust legally, right?
Yes, the Russell Trust Association.
This is a charity,
not
though.
Charitable.
I was going to say, as you point out, it doesn't do anything for the outside community. It just does for each other, right?
And it's one of the few Yale societies that does not give to the community. All the money in Skull and Bones goes back to Skull and Bones, and they do have millions of dollars.
Where does that come from, and what do they do with it?
It comes from alumni donations. Alumni receive each year a little card that says that they should donate to the society. And I think it's generally for upkeep of the building, upkeep of Deer Island, and general maintenance. They have to pay for the four-course lobster dinners somehow.
Yes. And that's one of their regular rituals, right? These rather extravagant dinners.
Extravagant dinners Thursday nights and Sunday nights. They meet Thursdays and Sundays and are expected to remain in the tomb from about 6 to about 1 in the morning, which saps up a lot of time senior year.
Now, there are other secret societies at Yale. You disclose that you're a member of one yourself, but you didn't say which one.
Skrull and Key. Which is often lumped together with Skull and Bones, but it's actually a very different society. We didn't have this network. We didn't have this bent toward power. And I rationalized the way I stayed in it was because every Thursday and Sunday night I had access to a refrigerator that had free beer. And when you're a senior, free beer takes a very high priority in life.
Right, but Skull and Bones, no booze at Skull and Bones.
There's no alcohol in Skull and Bones because they feel that members should remain level-headed for discussions and debates.
And there are a couple of others. There's Brasilius, which was kind of the hippie secret society when I was there, they actually opened up the doors to non-members like
Brasilius has always seemed to me to be the friendliest of the Yale societies.
Do any of these other ones have anything like the impact of Skull and Bones?
Well, you have prestigious members in Keys. You have prestigious members in Wolf's Head. Even in Elihu, which has become sort of a joke society because now it takes applications for membership. But Joseph Lieberman was a member of Elihu in 1962, I think, which is the same year that Robert Kaiser, a top editor at the Washington Post, was also a member of Elihu, which is an interesting connection. So if you look at the presidential election of 2000, you see Bush, who was a member of Skull and Bones, Cheney, who went to Yale for a couple years and is distantly related to a family of men in Skull and Bones, Al Gore, who went to Harvard, and Joe Lieberman, who was a member of another Yale secret society. I think that's pretty weird.
Very much so. Is there anything like this at other institutions like Harvard or any other prestige
university? Harvard has something called Final Club. Their top club is an institution called Porcellian, and Theodore Roosevelt was a member of Porcellian. FDR was rejected from Porcellian and called it the greatest snub of his life. But I think nothing has matched the secrecy and the intrigue of a place like Skull and Bones.
And then there's a wonderful anecdote about Kingman Brewster, as the president of Yale in the 70s, rejecting the tap from Skull and Bones.
Yeah, he's known as a stud on the Yale campus. People don't often reject Skull and Bones.
Any sense of why he did?
Oh, who knows? I've heard good things about the man. I heard he was an excellent president and an excellent person. I guess that's sort of a dangerous statement to make, but maybe that's why he rejected membership.
Well, he was a very liberal president of Yale in the early 70s and got nationally famous for saying that no Black Panther could get a fair trial anywhere in the United States, which... caused newspaper editorialists across the country to denounce him as a communist.
And he was one of the few presidents at Yale who were not members of Yale secret societies for about 150 years or so.
And so is this, you know, Skull and Bones going to survive for another century?
Unfortunately, I think it probably will. There's when the Yale administration sort of accepts the idea of Yale secret societies, and the dean of Yale College now is a member of a Yale secret society, as are other members of the administration. And when people across the country sort of refuse to accept the idea that Skull and Bones has such influence, because they sort of dismiss anything Skull and Bones as the rumblings of conspiracy theorists, I think there's little that's going to be able to tear this society down unless more people are aware and unless more people sort of go after this institution and try to hold people like George W. Bush accountable for their appointments and say, wait a minute, you were a member of Skull and Bones. He was a member of Skull and Bones. Is this guy a person of merit? Is he the best man for the job, or are you just appointing him because he's a member of your secret society? I think we just need to spread awareness.
And finally, any nasty phone calls from Bonesmen outraged by your book?
I haven't gotten personal phone calls, but I have heard that the Bonesman who threatened my career has been trash-talking me to editors. I've heard through the grapevine that Skull and Bones is angry about this book, which probably means I did my job. But I should add that I have a website, secretsofthetomb.com, and anybody who has questions about the society or who wants to read the book or an excerpt can go there for help.
Well, thanks for joining us, Alexandra Robbins, who is the author of Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, the Ivy League, and the Hidden Paths of Power. And that website again, secretsofthetomb, all one word, .com. And we'll be back in just a minute to listen to Linda Gruen.
Just real.
song Insignificance from the Mekons. Oh, it's a nice commentary on conspiracy, and of course, tomorrow being the anniversary of the Kennedy assassination, especially appropriate. I meant to ask Alexander Robbins if Bones is involved in that, but perhaps I'll email her and get a follow-up. Today is a National Day of Action. Oh, I should say, this is Doug Henley. The show is Behind the News, WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. And again, Alexander Robbins' website, Secrets of the Temple. SecretsOfTheTomb.com. SecretsOfTheTomb.com. Today is a National Day of Action organized by the United Farm Food and Commercial Workers Union against Walmart. They're trying to organize the world's largest company. And so I recorded this interview yesterday with a former Walmart worker turned union organizer, Linda Gruen, who is based in Las Vegas but is helping organize some activities in Seattle. Linda Gruen.
Welcome to WBAI, Linda Gruen. First of all, tell us how you got to this position of being a union person trying to organize Walmart.
Well, I was a Walmart worker. I worked for Walmart for 6.5 years, and about 2 years ago, a union organizer came to my door and explained that there was an active campaign going on in my store, and could he talk to me for a little while? And I said, sure, come on in. And I listened to everything that he had to say, and a lot of it was true. And I guess from that point on, I just kind of got involved in our campaign in the store. I was on the organizing committee. I did pretty much everything they asked me to do, you know, that we needed to do to have our campaign active. I did some radio spots, newspaper interviews, TV interviews, whatever it took to get our message out there. And after our election was postponed because of some violations by Walmart that the labor board saw fit to issue complaints on, we were just kind of stagnated there for a while, and I got more involved with the union, and they offered me a job. So that's where I am now.
What were you doing and where when you first heard the union message?
I was working at a Sam's Club in Las Vegas.
Tell us something about your experiences working there that made you receptive to the organizer's message.
I think the biggest thing for me was the fact that our health care was so bad. I had an ongoing health problem, and I needed good health care insurance. And the stuff that Walmart offered, it was a self-insured plan and was expensive and didn't pay for a lot of things. And the things that it did pay for didn't pay well on. So that was always something that interested me. And there's a lot of other stuff going on in the store as far as really bad treatment of a lot of people that work there. But it was kind of like, as long as it wasn't happening to me, I didn't really pay much attention to it. But when the organizer came to my door, like I said, healthcare was the biggest thing. But when they started talking about all this stuff, and then I kind of started watching what was going on in the store and how unhappy everyone was. That was pretty obvious before, even. But
what kind of bad treatment are you talking about? Why are people unhappy?
Oh, the favoritism that went on in the store was just, it was almost ludicrous. It was so open. There were a few pets in the store, and they got everything they wanted. They got merit raises. They got the jobs they wanted. It's Walmart's policy to post jobs, and everyone's able to apply for them. But in that store, and I'm sure in many others, because I've heard stories from other workers as well, those jobs were all, it was all predetermined who was going to get them before they were even posted.
On the basis of what? What made people favorites?
I guess having that blind loyalty to Walmart and never questioning anything they said. And it's a weird thing. It's almost like a little subculture in there. And when they hire people, they look for a certain type of person that's going to do this, that's going to just go along with everything they say. If you have any kind of a free thought or question anything that they do, you're not on the favorite list. If anything seems not fair or not right and you question it, you're on the bad list. Pretty much the favorites just are the ones that went along with everything management said. You know, they weren't the free thinkers. They weren't the creative people or the...
What is supposed to inspire this loyalty? They pay rather low wages and offer no benefits. What do they expect
do.
To... why should people give them anything in return out of the ordinary?
When they hire, they look for a certain kind of person. They like single mothers. People who, once they have this job, will be so afraid to leave because they need the check coming in week to week. They like people who are living paycheck to paycheck. They maybe kind of look for people who have some kind of turmoil in their lives or bad home life, where management will do one or two nice things and all of a sudden they become their family, and these people would rather go to work than stay home. We had to take a little test or personality survey, and it's called an Orion survey. And if you answer one question wrong on that, and it's a strongly agree to strongly disagree kind of thing, multiple choice, and if you answer one thing wrong or against what they want you to answer, you won't get hired.
We're recording this on Wednesday, but Thursday is the National Day of Action against Walmart.
Yes.
Could you describe the action and what you hope to accomplish with it?
Sure. We would like to bring out to the public and to union members of all unions and workers all across the United States that Walmart needs to start being a good corporate citizen. They need to start providing health care for all of their workers, not just some of them. If you are a part-time worker there, you don't even qualify for health insurance until you've been there 2 years. And then it is so costly that you probably, working part-time, can't afford it anyway. But they need to have affordable health care available to everyone. They need to start paying a living wage.
What are the wages like in general?
In the Walmart stores, it varies from state to state, of course, because some states have a higher minimum wage. But when I was hired several years ago, it was minimum wage in the stores. The warehouses paid a little higher, and the Sam's Clubs pay a little higher. And I found that in our Sam's Club in Las Vegas, it was totally up to the manager. They're hiring in people off the street who the manager thinks will be good pro-Walmart, anti-union people, and they're paying them more than people who have been there for 5 years, which would never happen in a union store. Their people are paid according to their seniority, and, you know, when you've worked a certain number of hours, you get a raise. And that isn't how it happens at Walmart. They seem to now being or leaving it up to the store managers how much they're going to start people off at. But even so, you know, you might start off at what you think is a pretty good rate, but after the first year, the raises stop, and you're stuck at a below a comfortable living wage rate of pay for quite some time. We have people at our store in Vegas that have been there 5 years that barely make $10 an hour.
When the national average is, what, 13, 14, so we're talking...
I think so.
Very,
probably.
Very low averages.
And it varies from city to city because, you know, like some cities, the living wage is going to be a lot lower than others. But Vegas isn't exactly a cheap place to live.
Walmart is just revered by Wall Street and in the business press as the company that does everything right. It's become the world's largest and most profitable company because, you know, it's seen as this great, productive, and efficient machine. How's it feel to hear that kind of talk? How's it compare with actually working there?
I think if you work there, you find out that it's not quite such an efficient machine at the store level. I think people that work there kind of wonder how the company runs so seemingly smoothly and grows so much every year. There's a lot of disruption that goes on in the stores. The turnover is huge, like 70%, and you just kind of wonder how can they run a company and have this much turnover. Nobody ever knows anything at the store level. As a customer, I don't know if you shop there, but if anyone listening has shopped there, you probably can tell this when you ask assistance from an associate at Walmart. Usually they don't know what you're asking for, or they have to call someone else to help. And that's because of the huge turnover. As far as the people in the stores who are trying to organize the stores, I think they see this amount of money that's made by Walmart, and all they can think of is why can't they provide us with decent health care and why can't they pay us a living wage when they're making so much money and their profits go up every year and they open more stores every year. It it's just a real a big question with all of the workers who are trying to organize.
Walmart's gain is the workers' loss. What this is an intensely anti-union company with very deep pockets that can fight organizing efforts on every front. What's your strategy for facing this monster?
Unfortunately, I'm not privy to the strategy of the powers that be within the UFCW who have this campaign going on. Right now, I'm not in that department working on the Walmart campaign, but we realize that it's going to take a long time. It's not going to happen overnight. It's hard because of the turnover. A lot of the people just get frustrated and quit and get a job somewhere else. But I think it's going to be a matter of just hanging in there, and sooner or later, there'll be one store that everything goes right, and they will get their election, and Walmart won't be able to scare everybody, and they'll vote the union in. And I think, personally, I think when that happens, that a lot of stores around the country will see that, and the workers will be less afraid and stick together and make it happen. But it's not going to happen overnight. It's going to take a long time.
And you're not calling for people to boycott Walmart, right?
Oh, no. No, uh-uh. We don't want to put them out of business. We just want them to come in line with all the union employers, the grocery stores. They've kind of invaded the grocery business now, and that's hurting a lot of these union grocery stores. Walmart will undercut prices because their overhead's not as much, their payroll's less, and their benefits that they provide to their workers are less. And they also intimidate suppliers to get cheaper prices on their goods. So we just want to level the playing field. We want them to operate from the same page we're operating from. We don't have any intention of putting them out of business, and we understand that that will never happen. You know, we're not stupid about it.
And so what do you have planned for Seattle on the day of action?
We're having a rally at one of our stores here in Renton, Washington, which is just a little southeast of the city of Seattle. We've got speakers from the religious community, some political people up there speaking. Quite a few members of other unions are attending. Jobs with Justice has helped us a lot in getting a lot of people out, getting the message out to people. We're planning a short march to the Walmart store. And pretty much the same thing that's going on all around the country. I think our plans are pretty much in line. Everyone around the country we all have the same message we want to bring, and this is a pretty standard way to do it. And we're not going to block anyone from going into a Walmart store. We're not going to solicit any Walmart employees. We just want to get the message out there to the public, and we want the Walmart stores to see that the union's not going away, and we want the workers to see that they've got a lot of support if they do want to organize.
What kind of reaction do you get from the workers when you talk to them? Are they interested but afraid, or are they hostile to the very idea of a union? What's the range of reactions?
Some of them will talk to us. A lot of them are afraid. And this is mostly from my work in Las Vegas. I see this. I'm not involved in an organizing campaign in Seattle. But when I did this in Las Vegas, because of the fact that I had worked at a store there, and pretty much all the people in the stores there know that the Sam's Club that I worked in was the store that petitioned for the vote, and that there was a lot of union activity in there. So a lot of times they were curious about it. We have been contacted individually by a lot of workers around the country who want information or want to try to start a campaign in their store. But for the most part, people are afraid. They're afraid they'll lose their jobs. They're afraid if they even breathe the word union, they'll lose their jobs. And that's really sad, because it's a right that all Americans have to try to organize their workplace. And Walmart just comes down real heavy-handed on that.
Good luck with the action, and thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Doug.
And that was Linda Gruen, who is a former Walmart worker turned organizer with the United Food and Commercial Workers Union. An interview I recorded yesterday in honor of the union's Day of Action Against Walmart today. And we'll be back after this word from Pink Floyd to speak with Amy Kayatsa about the state of women in the United States. For the final segment of Behind the News, this is Doug Henwood, the show and the radio station is WBAI 99.5 FM in New York. And a reminder that all this stuff, all these shows are now archived on my website. So if you want to go listen, visit leftbusinessobserver.com. That's my website, and you will find a link to the radio archives. And now we're joined by Amy Kayatsa, who is the director of a vast research project that the Institute for Women's Policy Research undertook and has just published the results of. Their website, if you want the report, is iwpr.org, and it's an overview of the state-by-state status of women in the United States. Welcome to WBAI, Amy Kayatsa.
Thank you very much. I'm glad to be here.
So, start with a vulgar journalistic ranking. You've got a list of the best and worst states for women in the United States. Give us a little rundown on the Scroll of Honor and Shame.
Okay. Well, the Scroll of Honor belongs to the best states for women are tied with Massachusetts, Minnesota, and Vermont at the top, followed by Connecticut, Washington, Alaska, Maine, and New Hampshire. So most of them are in New England, northeastern states, or in the West. With a few exceptions, like Minnesota. And the worst states are primarily in the Southeast, states like Mississippi, Tennessee, Kentucky, Oklahoma, Arkansas, and Alabama, along with Pennsylvania, Florida, and Indiana. Indiana and Pennsylvania are the only two that are not in the Southeast.
Now, in general, you know, these correspond to the general state of social indicators in these various states, you know, poverty, income levels, those kinds of things. Is this an accident?
No, not really. These are all states. The indicators that we look at in some ways replicate those kinds of indicators. We look at women's poverty, and those kinds of trends are going to be very similar to men's poverty. We look at women's earnings, and in states with low earnings for women, often there are low earnings for men. But we also look at some relative kinds of indicators. So we look at the ratio of women's to men's earnings so that we can get a sense of how women are or are not sharing in the wealth or poverty of each of the states.
And what about the trends over time? I mean, have things been getting better for women across the states, or are they changing their rankings? What's going on?
There are kind of mixed results. On a few of our indicators, we are seeing some improvements. Things like educational attainment and women's labor force participation, we've seen really go up over the past decade or so. In some other areas, things are not as good as they used to be, in fact. We're seeing fewer women that have health insurance, and we're also seeing an erosion of reproductive rights in many cases, and that's changed the rankings on several of the states.
Yeah, could you talk a bit about the reproductive rights situation?
Definitely. We've seen more and more restrictions on reproductive rights. We had many of the states that we have studied have adopted provisions that make it more difficult for women to access abortion. We look at the number of women who live in counties with abortion providers, and that's been dropping over the past 10 years, in part because there's a lot of threats to doctors who provide abortions. We've seen more restrictions like waiting periods adopted by different states, And we've also seen some states drop things like sex education. One of the areas in which there's been an improvement is that more states require insurance companies to cover contraceptives, which we see as a good thing. Although the cynics among us think that that's primarily because of Viagra, and when Viagra was covered by insurance companies, it forced states to say, hey, we need some equity.
Not New York State, though.
Yes.
And actually, going back to our previous segment, Walmart, of course, is the subject of a lawsuit now because it won't cover contraceptives in its rather weak medical plan. Well, since purely local interest, how does New York come in here?
New York does pretty well in some areas, although it does very poorly in others. It's up in the top 10 for reproductive rights. It's 12th for employment and earnings. But there are a few areas in which New York does very poorly. It's 43rd in the country for women's health and well-being. So that's more or less its lowest area.
Why so low?
Well, what we look at are things like mortality rates from heart disease and cancer and incidences of chlamydia and diabetes. And across the board, New York actually doesn't do very well in a lot of those areas.
Are these diseases of poverty for the most part?
To some extent, yes. I think there are also environmental factors. We see all states that have very big urban centers doing more poorly on these kinds of indicators. You know, fresh air and pollution and things like that can affect things like lung cancer, for example.
How much of this, these rankings or these positions are the results of just the general social structure of a state, and how much is specifically pro-woman kinds of policies that the state governments have adopted?
I think it's a mix. It's definitely true that there is a link between women's status and the general overall status and economic status of a state. And it's also true that women do better in white-collar economies than in blue-collar economies. And that's men do better than women do in blue-collar economies, although white-collar economies are good for all of us. But we also have really seen that policy can have a strong effect on how women are doing. There are many states that have weaker equal opportunity laws than others. There are many states that pay more attention to public health among women, for example. And we have seen that the states adopting better policies for women are doing better generally in terms of women's status.
One of your components of your one of the sub-indexes that put together, that comprise your full index, is a social and economic autonomy composite index. What's that all about, and how do the states score?
That includes things like whether the proportion of women who have health insurance, educational attainment, the proportion of businesses owned by women, and the percent of women above the poverty line. These are all areas in which, for the most part, we've seen some improvement over the past decade, although not with health insurance. New York actually comes out right in the middle. They're 25th for this particular indicator, but it's 43rd for the percent of women above poverty. So that's an area where it's definitely lagging behind some of the other states. Health insurance coverage in New York is also pretty weak. It's 38th in the country. On the other hand, New York is 12th in the country for educational attainment, which in some ways is not surprising. Again, one of the things that big cities, big urban areas do is attract well-educated women. They result in increased earnings. But they also are often associated with high levels of inequality, and that's where you see your poverty coming in. And, you know, this is also something that's closely linked to race and ethnicity, since those are linked to socioeconomic status. So the more diverse a state, often you'll see higher poverty.
And how salient are these things as political issues? Are they things people pay attention to, or are they kind of obscure in the broad political dialogue?
Well, I think it depends on what state you live in and what city you live in to some extent. When we do these reports, we work pretty closely with women's activists and policymakers in the states. And we have seen the reports and the rankings of the states make a difference in some state legislatures in terms of the policies that's been adopted. Interestingly, we can see a lot more powerful effects in some of the southeastern states that are doing really poorly, I think in part because there's just such a lack of information that once it's out there, it's easier to make the case for these kinds of policies. And that's enabled women's issues to really be a little bit more visible in those states than it was before.
Well, and your important part of that informing effort. Thanks for doing the report, and thanks for joining us, Amy Kayatsa.
Thank you.
Who directed this vast research project for the Institute for Women's Policy Research, a D.C.-based think tank. And again, this report and individual state reports are available on their website at iwpr.org. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. We'll be off next week for the usual Thanksgiving holiday and back the week after. Stay tuned for the news, and let's go out with this little item from Pink, of all people.